Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
One day soon, when spring arrives and the ice is out, you might spot the great egret, that lovely white-feathered stalker of Minnesota lakes and ponds. If you do, know that moment is courtesy of a century-old law, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Before the act became law in 1918, these egrets and other birds were almost extinct from sport shooting and being killed for their feathers to decorate women's hats. This morning, we're talking about the impact of that law and the place that birds hold in our world. We were inspired to do this show by National Geographic's launch of its Year of the Bird initiative, an effort dedicated to celebrating and protecting birds. The magazine's photography is stunning, as always, and the writing, well, it doesn't get much better than that. Novelist Jonathan Franzen wrote the January cover story for National Geographic's launch of the initiative called Why Birds Matter. His books, The Corrections, Purity, and others place him among the nation's most celebrated novelists. Jonathan is also an avid birder, and he's our guest this morning. We want to hear from you, too. Are you a serious birder or just a casual admirer of bird songs? And have you ever thought how birds connect us to nature? Or maybe you're wondering, what's the big deal with birds? Wherever you land, join the conversation at 800-242-2828. John, thank you, and welcome back to NPR.
Oh, it's always nice to be here.
It's a snowy New York, I presume. How are you handling, what, the fourth nor'easter in the last couple of weeks?
You know, they shut down everything yesterday, and today there's like 3 inches of quickly melting snow on the ground. It was a kind of big nothing of a storm.
Right. Something short of the apocalyptic storm that we
Something heard. Short of the Twin Cities, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks for talking with us, John, about birds. What was your reaction to being asked to write on behalf of birds for National Geographic? How did that come about?
I had done a piece for them some years ago about the killing of migratory songbirds in the Mediterranean, which is a huge problem, and had a good experience with them, and they've been trying to get me back to do something. And then they said, it's the year of the bird. We want a short piece on why birds matter. And frankly, my heart sank because to have 2,000 words to talk about why birds matter, it was really constraining. So it was actually you know, as a piece of writing, it was a real challenge to find something cogent to say in that little space.
Have you thought about it much before you were given this assignment? Why birds matter, or do you just enjoy the endeavor of looking for birds and hearing them?
You know, my agent has informed me that people, that readers of mine, some readers, now wince whenever I bring up birds. I actually have written a lot about them in the last 12 years since I was smitten with them. Some of those pieces quite long, 12,000 words in a piece called My Bird Problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a little elevator speech about why they're great. And it's like literally the question I get asked every time I do an interview. What is it about birds? So I kind of knew what I wanted to say. And yet, for people who were unpersuaded, it's tricky to make a case for birds. And it's particularly tricky because ultimately, you can't really make an economic case. And everything is economic now. So you have to make a values case. And values cases are tough to make.
Right. It's in your piece for National Geographic. It's about, you put it on the, it's a moral question or a moral value that you describe, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, there was between the last giant extinction event 65 million years ago and now, there was this incredible natural world. And if you look at the time scale, then at the very end, like the last second before midnight, here comes human beings and utterly transform the planet. So you have we can go even further back and talk about the dinosaurs. And birds, of course, are direct lineal descendants of the dinosaurs. You have this natural world that has basically been around forever and that we are the products of. And it seemed to me that there was a case to be made that we owed something in the same way we owe something to our parents. And I in fact, brought up the story of King Lear and these mm-hmm. ungrateful daughters. And he's saying, look, I don't need everything. I just need a little bit. Give me my little contingent of courtiers and my little guard of soldiers. That's all I'm asking for. I'm not asking for a lot. And I think we immediately recognize that Reagan and Goneril in that play are kind of monsters because he's not – and they say, you know, well, there's no need of it. Mm-hmm. And he has this great line, "O reason not the need," which is to say, don't apply an economic standard here. Talk about just basic grace toward this natural world that we are a product of. And in fact, you don't have to like turn the world into some environmentalist paradise. You just have to make reasonable accommodations, and birds can still thrive. And they are the big representatives of that natural world. They're the part of the natural world that you find everywhere. They're on the sidewalk outside the building I'm in Manhattan, and they're in the middle of the ocean. They're in the middle of the desert. They're absolutely everywhere. And I think we do have a responsibility to, if we care at all, if we have any respect at all for the natural world, we have to do something to keep birds in it.
And it seems that that sort of sense of enlightenment was in place in the early 20th century when this Migratory Bird Treaty Act was put into place that foresaw this reason for birds that was beyond an economic value. Do you think?
I think so, yeah. America is an interesting case because if you read the early accounts of people arriving here, something they would talk about unbelievable numbers of oysters the size of, you know, two man's hands. But what they all talked about was just the unbelievable plenitude, bounty of bird life. The sky going black when flocks of passenger pigeons would go over. Everywhere by European standards, it was just this avian paradise. It was just incredible everywhere, birds. And so that was still in people's memory by the end of the 19th century when that world had basically collapsed and the passenger pigeon was extinct, the Carolina parakeet was extinct, and suddenly these super common birds, the great egret, the snowy egret, they were almost extinct. And so right around the turn of the 20th century, you saw the creation of the National Audubon Society, which was not initially called, but that became the National Audubon Society, basically saying, let's stop killing these birds. And close on that, in the spirit of Theodore Roosevelt and awareness that nature was not infinite, that we were, in fact, running out of natural areas in the U.S., and also recognizing that a lot of what we consider our birds cross national borders, mm-hmm. With Canada, with Mexico, because they winter in the south. One of the results was this great treaty, and then, of course, an act backing it up, an act of Congress, which basically made it illegal to kill a bird that migrates, mm-hmm. With a few exceptions for ducks and woodcock and a few other things.
Mm-hmm. You've told the story before, you've written about it, but would you mind repeating how it all began for you with birds?
For me, well, it began here in New York, really. I mean, I'd started to pay attention to birds around the time my mom died. I don't know entirely why. Part of it was I didn't have kids, and now I had no parents, and so I had free time. And also, you know, in retrospect, I had a lot of love that was not, you know, I love my friends, I love my partner, but there was a lot of excess love. And so I started to pay attention to these small animals that were all around me. And then one day in May of 2000, I went out to Central Park and with my partner's sister and brother-in-law, and who are birders, and they handed me a pair of binoculars and said, just look around. Mm. And it was incredible. It was like, you know, migration in New York City is people come from around the world for it because you can see 100 kinds of birds in one walk in one afternoon in Central Park.
Right. Our guest in this hour is Jonathan Franzen, the novelist and birder. He also wrote the opening piece of prose in National Geographic's cover story, Why Birds Matter, as National Geographic launches its Year of the Bird. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you have an epiphanic moment related to birds you'd like to share with us. 1-800-242-2828, 800-242-2828. John, I one can assume that the writer's life is solitary and quiet and spent largely in front of a notebook or a screen. Is there for you as a writer something about birds that takes you out of your work routine or your writing routine or out of your workspace?
Yeah, when I was first smitten with birds, there was a direct conflict between the two because it's the best time to bird is first thing in the morning. And for me, the only time to write is first thing in the morning. So after the corrections had taken some pressure off me financially and otherwise, I would face this choice in the morning. Do I go birding or do I go try to work on this novel set in Minnesota, by the way, that I seem unable to write? And for about a year, I, as often as not, I would say, heck, I'm just going to go birding. I no longer do that. I basically work when I'm home. But when I travel, sometimes I travel specifically to see birds. Sometimes I travel to do journalism about birds. And sometimes I travel like on a book tour. And I try to make sure that there are days in the course of a book tour where I can just go out and leave it all behind. And those are days that just go by like it's as if the day lasted 10 minutes. They go by so quickly because I'm so completely immersed and absorbed.
Let's go to the phones. Mary, in Stillwater, you're on with John and myself. What's your thinking about birds? What's your experience?
Well, my family, we went on a safari to Tanzania just this past January, and I was looking forward to seeing the elephants and the giraffes, you know, all the big animals. And the gal who helped us with the trip said, wait till you see the birds. And I'm like, yeah, okay. We went there, and the birds between, I mean, they were like 4-foot-tall birds, and they were little, tiny, gorgeous birds. And I was totally unexpected and delighted, and the birds were just magnificent. So it really opened my eyes.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I hear that a lot, actually. Yeah, no, I actually have a couple of friends who've come back from precisely that kind of trip in East Africa saying the birds turned out to be the stars. And that's part of the attraction of birdwatching is the mammals are hard to see. Not so hard in East Africa, but even there, you don't run into a leopard every hour, whereas you are never far from a bird. In fact, anywhere in the world you're never far from the bird, but they're very concentrated, and some of them spectacular, the lilac-breasted roller and the Cory bustard. I mean, incredible birds in East Africa, yeah.
You can really roll off the names of these birds, can't you?
Yeah, you know.
It's like another
language.
Like
I said, my parents are gone, I don't have any kids, and many, many a writing day is not very productive, so... I spent some time paying, you know.
It was not an indictment. I thought it's impressive, actually.
Oh, thank you. I also do work in bird conservation. I'm involved very much in the American Bird Conservancy and pay close attention to a number of other conservation projects in both the Old World and the New World.
Right.
So, it's in my life every day, and you do learn things.
Mary's anecdote from Tanzania reminds me of the line in your piece for National Geographic. You wrote that this is a lift from a larger sentence. The most vivid and widespread representatives of the Earth as it was before people arrived on it. That's how you describe birds. The most vivid and widespread representatives of the Earth as it was before people arrived on it. And it would seem that in East Africa and maybe in other underdeveloped or less developed places, I should say, birding is, you're much more close to something that existed before humans walked this place, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Minnesota, lots of ducks. Mm-hmm. Ducks are an incredibly ancient species. There are some details of sexual anatomy that connect them more directly to the dinosaurs than most other birds are connected to them. But when you look at a duck on a pond, even just a mallard on a pond or a lake in Minnesota, you're seeing something that looked like that. Probably exactly like that 20 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And what's more, sounded like that. We have these fossils from a subantarctic island showing, which are 55 or 57 million year old fossils of kind of early geese. And the fossils are so well preserved that the syrinx, which is the voice box of the goose, is fossilized. And it looks just like a goose syrinx today, which means that 57 million years ago, there were geese that were honking. It's incredible.
Back to the phones. Bryce in Sioux Falls, you're on with John and myself.
Hey, the comment I wanted to make, I live in Southern Colorado, is the vibrancy that birds bring to rivers. I live in a high alpine desert, and along the waterways is where you find most of the fowl. And I think about what would it be like without birds there. It would be just a bleak scene compared to the life and the dynamism that birds bring to that. So that's all.
Okay. Good observation.
That's a great comment. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a problem in the West because water is becoming a scarce commodity. And particularly in Arizona, unbelievable riparian corridors that are critical for migrating birds and also critical for resident birds. And you're out in the desert and in Arizona, and then you come down into this river area. And if there's any water in it, it's just like suddenly you're surrounded by life.
Right. Here in the Twin Cities, where we're broadcasting today, we're in the smack in the middle of the Mississippi Flyway. And, of course, we have a lot of birds that occur here year-round, but we also get to see the travelers both in the spring and the fall. Do you spend a lot of time along rivers when you're in New York?
Along rivers?
Yeah.
Well, there's the Hudson, so yeah. In a sense, I'm always along a river. I no longer really live in New York. I happen to be back visiting. I'm in Santa Cruz, California, now full time, and that's more coastal as well, not so much river. In Minnesota, it's really the wetlands and the forests that I like to bird in. You know, Aiken County up north is an international destination. People come from other countries to go birding in Aiken County in June. But right in St. Paul, I mean, you've got your bald eagles
right
in Mississippi right there. It's incredible.
Right. What have you seen change? What changes have you seen in the years since you became, a full-time or a
smitten.
More
yeah.
smitten by birds. What have you observed? Are you optimistic or less so about bird populations and their treatment at the hands of humans and civilization and change?
Well, I am a bit of a depressive pessimist about everything. And, you know, at the end of every year I say, wow, somehow we made it to the end of that year. Not so sure about next year. So, the big picture, particularly with the certainty of catastrophic climate change that we're now facing, is kind of tough to contemplate, not only for the natural world but for human beings. Nevertheless, one of the things you learn if you pay attention to birds is how successful they are. They are, you know, the dinosaurs all died out. Except for the birds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few other things also made it through that extinction event. But the birds not only survived the meteor impact 65 million years ago, they took over the world. They're really, really good at surviving. And one of the things you learn if you're a bird conservationist is they don't need much. Mm-hmm. They don't need pristine nature. They just need some semi-functioning wild area where they can complete a life cycle. They're unbelievably fecund. You know, the warblers that breed in northern Minnesota, they will, you know, the reason they migrate is there are so many bugs up there. There are so many little worms on the trees that they just are like swimming in calories, and they can fledge 5 chicks. Well, you do the math, 5 chicks and then maybe 50% mortality on migration. That's still, you're getting 2.5 extra birds for a pair of birds. Every year, geometrically, if they just have it, if you could keep on giving them the place to do that, they will really populate it. So that's a broad cause for optimism, I think, regarding birds, is they are survivors, and they just need half a chance.
We've got time for one more phone call. Sue from Rosemont, you're on.
Hi. I have a backyard. I wanted to know, should I put out bird seed and not fertilize, or what? You know, I'm a little bit worried about how to attract birds to our backyard without doing anything unnatural.
John, can you, from your perch in New York, can you give a South Metro Twin Cities
Absolutely.
Birder
Absolutely.
A little advice?
Yeah. Okay, if you want to help the birds in your backyard, the number one thing, huge, biggest thing is if you have a cat, keep it indoors. That's like if you do nothing else, you've already done 80% of what you can do as someone living in a suburban area to help birds. Because outdoor cats are the leading direct cause of mortality for North American songbirds. We're talking about a billion plus birds killed a year by cats. So that's one thing. It's good to put out feeders, actually. They're probably not going to pay much attention to them in the summer. But in the winter, people worry that, oh, they're going to become dependent on the feeders and they will lose the ability to find seeds on their own. No, doesn't happen. What you're doing, actually, by putting out feeders in the winter is helping individuals that might not have made it through the winter because there is mortality in the winter. You're helping them get enough calories that they might have a chance to successfully reproduce in the spring as opposed to maybe failed breeding in the spring. So it's a huge benefit for the local birds. The one important thing is if you do have a feeder, feeders are good. If you spread the seed on the ground, for one thing, it might sprout. They're also more vulnerable to predators when they're on the ground. But the only important thing with feeders is that you wash them every couple of times you fill them. You need to wash them with warm, soapy water because the one downside for feeders really is that they can spread avian diseases.
Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
It's been a pleasure, always.
Well, good luck and hope you have a good season and good luck writing.
Thank you very much.
Our guest in this hour has been Jonathan Franzen, novelist and writer of National Geographic's January cover story, Why Birds Matter. It's a part of National Geographic's year-long initiative that it has declared the Year of the Bird. And we'll continue our conversation in the next half hour and give you some more, maybe some more specific tips. You heard some from Jonathan Franzen on where to see birds in Minnesota. He mentioned specifically Aiken County. We're going to have a lot more of that kind of conversation coming up in the next half hour. This is a time of year to reflect on what we're most thankful for at NPR News. We're thankful for our members, people like Paul in Malacca, Jed and Catherine in Minnetonka, and Haynes from Sweden, who have made the decision to support quality news coverage from around the state and around the world. Thank you for being a part of the incredible community that powers NPR News. Let's get a check now of news. Here's Phil Picardi.
Good morning, Mike. Authorities are confident the 23-year-old man who blew himself up as police closed in was behind this month's Austin, Texas bombings, but they still do not know why he did it. Police say Mark Condit left behind a 25-minute cell phone video that details the differences in the bombs he built, but they are still trying to determine why he planted them and whether he picked his targets at random. The bombs killed two people and injured four others over 3 weeks. President Trump is targeting China for stealing American technology, and in the U.S., farmers, electronics retailers, and other businesses are bracing for a backlash. Today, the Trump administration is expected to slap trade sanctions on China that could include restrictions on Chinese investment and tariffs on Chinese products. Industry groups have warned Trump that sweeping tariffs could trigger a chain reaction that could hurt the U.S. economy. Congressional leaders have finalized a sweeping $1.3 trillion budget bill, and voting on it could begin as soon as today. The measure substantially boosts military and domestic spending, but does not address the dreamer immigrants and deprives President Trump of some of his border wall money. The White House says Trump backs the legislation, though he grumbled in a tweet this morning, had to waste money on Dem giveaways in order to take care of military pay increase and new equipment. At least five people have been killed and several others wounded in a car bomb blast near a hotel in Somalia's capital of Mogadishu. Police say the explosion occurred near a road targeted by attacks in the past by the Somali-based extremist group Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab frequently attacks Mogadishu's high-profile areas, such as hotels and military checkpoints. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:31.
The Trump administration said last week that the U.S. electrical grid was hacked by Russia. I'm Mike Mulcahy. How do we keep the lights on? The answer may be more complicated than you think. We'll talk about it at 11.
Programming is supported by The Guthrie, now playing Familiar, a new play about a Zimbabwean-American family preparing for a wedding in Minnesota. The New York Times called it engrossing and fiercely funny. Through April 14th, tickets at GuthrieTheater.org. Environmental reporting is supported by All Energy Solar, St. Paul-based solar providers dedicated to making it easy and economical for Minnesotans to achieve energy independence. Learn if your home or business property qualifies for cost-effective solar. More info at allenergysolar.com.
And this is NPR News. Carrie Miller is off today. I'm Mike Edgerly. In this hour of the program, we're talking about birds. National Geographic magazine, if you haven't seen it in the current year, it's an amazing display of birds, photography and writing. They've declared this from their place in the publishing empire, this being the year of the bird. It's got to do with the century-old protection for birds called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which put in place a lot of protections for the migratory birds that that we enjoy here in Minnesota and throughout the country. Earlier this hour, you heard from novelist Jonathan Franzen talking about his obsession with birds. In this half hour, we're joined by Minnesota birder and blogger Ben Douglas, talking about the joys of birding in Minnesota and how he uses technology to find birds. We're going to refer to him as Big Ben Douglas because he says it's okay, and he's also 6'7". Ben, welcome to NPR News.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're taking note of this this hour about the proliferation of birds and the protection of birds. As someone who's an avid birder yourself, what does this all add up to you? I mean, are we in a good place with birds in Minnesota right now? And what's your observation, I should say?
Yeah, you know, I definitely think we're in a good place in Minnesota. There are so many conservation bodies, so many people deeply interested in the birds. And we have a lot of famous locations. When we think about places like the Sac Zim Bog and getting into the Big Year movie and things of that sort, we have so many people passionate about. We have so many conservatories, so many nature centers that are sprouting up and grabbing land and making it available for people, that I'm very, you know, confident in the trajectory of birding.
You can join our conversation with Ben at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to Dennis in Afton. You're on with Ben and Mike.
Oh, yeah, good morning. Yeah, thanks very much for the programming and your guests there. I just wanted to share that last spring my good neighbors gave me a bluebird house to repair, and I fixed it up and put it up, and the bluebirds jumped right in there. And in terms of birds, I'd just like to share, I think they outdo the Picassos and the Da Vincis. I mean, it's they're mobile art, and that's what I tell friends. They're mobile art, and they sing, too. So I'd rather look for the birds, actually, than a picture somewhere. I mean, it's they are unbelievable, and I hope we can help them out a lot. And my reward for putting up the one house was this past fall on my bird bath. There were 8 bluebirds circled there, just while the ice was forming in the bird bath. And so I'm thinking of putting up another house.
So, Dennis, what have you seen so far this spring, such as it is?
Well, the cardinals and the chickadees are around, and one question popped into my mind, if I can ask a question.
Sure.
Here. So a friend mentioned that in his garden, it seems the bluebirds put up a scrap with the wrens. Now, I don't want a bird to chase my wrens away, because they're my number one, really. they motivate me in the springtime with their chirping and the singing. I'm not sure if bluebirds sing. I haven't heard them sing yet. So two questions there.
Yeah, bluebirds definitely do sing or have a call. Certainly noticeable here in the spring. The more time you spend around them, you'll definitely hear them. It's a modified call that is loosely similar to an American robin, because they're both in the thrush family. But they definitely do sing, or definitely call from a perch. Now, as far as chasing your wrens off, that's probably not going to happen, because I found house wrens to be one of the more aggressive nesting birds. So if they find a cavity they like, they will chase everybody out of it. In fact, wrens will throw chickadees out of a nest. They will remove their eggs. They are exceedingly aggressive. But definitely one thing you can do is put up additional houses and take a look at some of the details online for distances between houses. Because a lot of times bluebirds will cohabitate in a space with other species like tree swallows and the like. As long as you separate the houses a certain distance apart, families won't habitate together next to each other, like two bluebird families directly next to each other. They need much more space apart from one another. But it's always a good idea to get more houses up in more spaces, providing that kind of habitat.
Right. Ben, how did you get started birding?
That's a really good question. I would say the seed for it was planted a very long time ago when I was young. I'd go over to my grandparents' place, especially with my mother, and my grandfather really enjoyed sitting on the porch, drinking coffee and watching the birds. And he wasn't so great at identification. We have a lot of interesting stories about him misidentifying birds. But at the end of the day, I spent a lot of those formative years sitting on the porch, observing birds with my grandparents and my mother. And my mom would always get excited about them, too. She would call me when I was at college and say, I had an indigo bunting. As she said it, I had a blue bird. And I was like, do you mean an indigo bunting? You know, and then she's like, yeah, that's what I mean. And, you know, her being infatuated with them and Blackburnian warblers really planted the seed for me and wanting to really get to know them.
Right. Well, I would never call myself a birder, but I love bird songs. The auditory aspect of birds is, I find, just a wonderful thing, especially this time of year when you go from a relatively quiet pre-dawn morning to a morning like this one, where it was just a cacophony, mainly of robins and maybe some other birds interspersed. But you identify, I mean, where does sound, what role does sound play in identifying and in enjoying bird life?
Yeah. When you talk about skill sets in birding, it is amazing how different those skill sets are, but how they overlap. You can spend your entire time just visually identifying birds, but then when you tune into that sound layer of the landscape around you and peel away the human elements or peel away the other things going on and start to listen to individual calls, you get to know their cadence, you get to know the different call types, how often a northern cardinal might change up its repertoire, how many different call types a black-capped chickadee might have. It's an absolutely critical element, and especially on migration, when the warblers come in from the neotropics, it is phenomenal what kind of different soundscapes you get and how many different birds you identify by call exclusively.
Do you mind if we try a little bird sound on you to see if you can identify this one?
Let's see if we can stump the expert. This should be really fun.
Let's stump Big Ben. Okay, we're going to give you one here. Let's just see if you can do this one.
That sounds like a house finch to me. There was actually one calling in the parking lot. I got here a little bit early with my wife. I had the windows down, and I was listening to the house sparrows and other things move around, and I was like, oh, there's a house finch.
Okay, you passed, Ben. You may continue with your appearance on NPR News.
You have no idea how important that was for the people listening that are my friends. I probably would have been thrown out of various clubs.
Okay, we're going to do one more. Let's just see if we can just mess with you just a little bit, okay?
That sounds like great blue herons on a rookery, most likely.
Pretty close. Great egret, the cousin, right, of the heron?
Yeah, they spend a lot of time together, actually. There's a rookery over on the St. Croix River just north of Stillwater, and you'll see great egrets, great blue herons, and double-crested cormorants all together on it. But, yeah, I'll probably get dinged by that.
No, that's okay. I notice in summer when I'm out on a waterway, I'll hear that call. And quite often, I'll look up and I've spooked a heron, and not an egret, but that sound seems so close, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of the interesting thing is it takes years to understand and to peel away these, you know, audio layers that you're getting from the birds, especially birds, and maybe not the egrets and stuff, so I don't have an excuse there. But when you think about the warblers, a lot of these warblers, 17, 18, 20 plus species, migrate through in just days in the spring, and then they're not calling in the fall. They're just trying to get back south. So you've got a really narrow window. If you don't study at home, it's going to be really hard to pick those up and know them right off the top of your head.
We have an online comment from Elizabeth in Minnetonka. Birds are kind of a gateway for children, even in the cities. I assume she means a gateway to nature. When great nephews see birds, they get really excited. It is a gateway to nature, right? Or a gateway drug to being obsessed with nature, right?
100% agree with that. I started college in zoology, actually, and I changed over to computer science. But my way back into the natural world for adventure, hiking, whatever it might be, was bird watching. And now I find when I'm out there, I start to notice wildflowers. If the bird calls are really quiet, it's the middle of summer, they're nesting and trying to be quiet, I pick up wildflowers, I pick up other mammals running around and start to do identification on that stuff as well. It is a gateway to the broader world.
Right. You can call us with your question or comment for Ben at 651-227-6000. Or toll-free 800-242-2828, 800-242-2828. That interconnectedness is just a wonderful part of nature, isn't it? I mean, it's just, I mean, especially for those of us who feel kind of locked in by the lack of daylight and maybe the brutally cold temperatures. You know, even in the depths of winter, there's something for us to, there is a way through birds to connect with nature, isn't there?
Absolutely. I went out on New Year's Day. I was at Jay Cook State Park before sunrise when I showed up, and I got out of the vehicle at negative 16 degrees. And there were pileated woodpeckers, there were chickadees out, the birds were moving, they have to eat. They don't have the option to go indoors other than maybe if they've got a burrow in a tree, but they are coming out to eat, they need to do their thing, and there is always something to find out there.
You're obsessive with this, and you mentioned earlier the big year. You've embarked on a sort of a crusade of sorts, right?
I have, yeah. I got a little bit of craziness in me when it comes to bird watching. And just this last year, a friend of mine and myself, Peter Nichols, we got out and found as many birds within Washington County as we could. So we had a big year within Washington County, trying to restrict ourselves a bit and find new places. But this year, I've decided to visit every state park that Minnesota offers and state recreational area. So there's 70-plus locations to visit inside this calendar year. I've ticked up 22 of them already this year, so I've gone out in every nasty bit of weather you could imagine, just trying to keep those numbers going and visit exciting places.
Now, do you ever go out and not hear or see a bird?
No, in fact, it's almost impossible. I've actually had conversations with friends about, is it possible to go out for an extended period of time, 2 hours, say, and not find a bird? And so far, it has not happened. I've had single-digit days where I've gone out to, like, Lake Elmo Park in Washington County and gone out for an hour and a half and found four species. Mm-hmm. I have never had a zero list since I've been birding.
Right. Do you keep the list? I mean, you're actually writing this down someplace.
My lists go into my cell phone. So a lot of people don't realize you can record your stuff with eBird, eBird.org. It's run by Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They have an app for Android and for Apple phones. And you can just plug lists directly in. They GPS locate you to the hotspot you're at, timings, the whole bit. And you start plugging your data in and you have an online portal for it and you can review your data. It's a really nice.
You've really crossed over into a very high-tech way of tracking a critter that descended from dinosaurs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
the opportunity, though, to mix technology with bird watching, there's so much in there. There's so much research to do. You know, we could get into hours of talking about searching Google Maps in satellite view to identify habitat types that might be prospective for given species. Something, again, my friend Pete Nichols, him and I do it all the time. We spend a lot of time looking at digital sources so that we're more successful when we get in the field.
Man, you are intense.
A little bit. I love it. Bird watching is just, I don't know. I spend a lot of time in front of a computer screen at work. So when I get out, I want to enjoy the world. And I prepare to enjoy the world.
Right. And that's what it's, I mean, we should be enjoying the world around us, right? And it's just the birds are your way into it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's all personality type. Anybody of any walk of life can enjoy bird watching. You don't have to have a set of binoculars. You don't have to have a high-end spotting scope. You can just walk out there and just enjoy the fact they're making noise and you recognize the differences in their noises or some of their looks. But everybody has their own way to enjoy it, and mine happens to be high-tech.
Awesome. Catherine in Minneapolis, you're on with Ben.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great, great topic. I'm not a birder. I'm a plant person, but we have this in plants, too. My question is, are we seeing different species here in the Twin Cities or Minnesota because of climate change? And are these just pass-through birds, or are they actually starting to be more common and settled here? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. There's probably a multiple sides to that. I would expect, and I have seen, that as we've had more extreme weather events occur, they have the tendency, especially during migratory windows, to push birds into our space that we wouldn't necessarily expect. Considering the fact we have a deep background in Minnesota birding, we would expect relatively few first state records to occur. But as those first state records do occur, like a sharp-tailed sandpiper showed up a couple of years ago, a gentleman by the name of Pete Hager found that bird. That may just be an identification issue that people didn't have the maturity to identify such a bird because it really doesn't stand out from the other shorebirds it looks like. But a couple of years ago in Washington County, we had wood stork show up in the county. A wood stork is really not supposed to be up here. So who knows what happened with it, vagrancy, whatever the like. But you start to look at patterns of things. About 4 years ago, an ivory gull showed up in Duluth in the harbor. An ivory gull is a once-in-a-decade type experience. And so I went up and got that bird. It was really super cold, and there's like 45 crazy people out there on the breakwater in the ice looking for this, you know, individual gull. It's hard to tell without looking at the data. And that's why I encourage people, even if you're not a birder, sign up for eBird and become a citizen scientist. They're analyzing the data we put in. All of these observations get boiled into some kind of a concept of, okay, is something happening here? But we are seeing bird expansion. The house finch that you called played for me earlier. Mm-hmm. I talked to individuals that have been birding here for 60 years, like Bob Jansen. When you go back in time, 40, 50 years, you couldn't find a house finch in Minnesota. Now you find house finches everywhere. They are ubiquitous. So it is not a static environment we live in. Bird populations ebb and flow based on a lot of characteristics. Some of it may not be climate change. We have birds retract from our range and then expand into that range. And depending on conservation programs that, you know, DDT removal had the bald eagles and trumpeter swans, you know, reestablish, all of these things change over time. So we should expect an ebb and flow in there. But finding those individuals and the oddities, that may lend us something.
Right. May actually be some value.
Yes.
To knowing this. Chris from St. Paul Park, you're on.
Hello. I was hoping that I wanted to ask your guest if he knew there's a family of crows that have been living at a house that in the yard here my grandfather built years and years ago. They seem to come back year after year. And there's one that I think he's the hierarchy of the clan. And he waits outside my door every morning in the summertime to kind of talk to me in the morning. And he does this one little thing. It's not a call at all. It's kind of like a real throaty kind of a, almost like a cat purr, except shorter. And I was wondering if your guest might know the meaning behind that sound.
Well, Chris, we don't think you're weird at all, so...
No, not at all. You know, and the interesting thing is crows are exceedingly intelligent. They're more intelligent than we possibly give them credit for as a member of the corvid species. And quite honestly, crows will manipulate you. He wants something from you, which is probably food. He's identifying you as a food source or, you know, a potential of some sort. Crows will go the opposite direction as well. You know, a lot of times there are actually hunting seasons on crows right. To this day. There's four of them in a given year. If you fire at a crow and that maybe actually, you know, were to kill one or whatever it might be, they will tell each other and say, you should probably stay away from this location. They don't like crows there. So the opposite is happening to you. They know that you like crows, that you, you know, are friendly to them and possibly have provided them food. So sometimes they become habituated, you know, to humans. And that low gurgle may just be a recognition. It may be, hey, I recognize you as a friend, so why don't you give me something to eat?
Right. They're brilliant animals, aren't they? I mean, they really are something. I'm not in the business of selling National Geographic magazines, but in one of the more, I think it was the February issue of National Geographic's bird series, there's a tale of a young girl, I think in California, who's rewarded with trinkets from crows whom she's provided some food or done something for. And if you think this is fantasy, there's an actual photo of the stuff the crows have dropped at her feet in her yard in California. It's an amazing story. And these crows are just... They're really something, aren't they?
Yeah, when you take a look at the slightly elevated measures of intelligence in some of those species, black-billed magpies are also in that family. But a lot of these corvids definitely are doing things out there that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And it may just happen in a microcosm. It may just be an individual bird that is a little more friendly to humans in general, isn't wary of them, you know, whatever that might be. But Minneapolis has a pretty massive crow roost as a regular basis, 10,000 plus birds in the wintertime before they distribute out to normal habitat.
And back to the phones. Dog from Red Wing, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a kind of unique experience. I decided to put cup plants in my yard. So my whole yard is now cup plants, and that's spelled C-U-P. And it's turned out to be just a wondrous habitat for all types of birds and also all types of insects, especially the honeybee, which you don't see too much anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was actually a caller earlier when Mr. Franzen was on that was talking about, you know, things in the yard, putting seed out and whatever. You know, a recommendation I would additionally make, and you have done, is putting native plantings in your yard can help birds more than you can possibly imagine. They provide retreat points, you know, safety locations, as well as unique seed opportunities that will help sustain them. So the more native plantings you have in your yard, you'll definitely attract some really great things.
Right. And if you don't cut them back going into winter, you leave these dead pods there. There are seeds in coneflowers and things like that that finches and other birds will gravitate to, right?
Absolutely. Any of that stuff. Don't cut it back until after winter. Allow those seed heads to be utilized by birds, migrants, resident birds, whatever it might be. There are a lot of species depending on that until a new food source grows. When they migrate back, they need old seed heads to scavenge off of until they get a regular food source growing fresh in the year.
And having some protection, that's a key part of this, isn't it?
It really is. You know, if we have nothing but lawns, if we're nothing but grass and have very little plantings around, you're not going to get a lot of activity at your feeders. They need a place to retreat to and feel safe from predators. Additionally, if you have a tree that, say, dies in your yard and it's basically, you know, you think it's unsightly, but that's a snag. That's an opportunity for birds to perch and go at. And so if it's not unsafe to anyone around you, you might consider leaving that in place and allowing the birds to use that to perch and hunt from themselves.
Back to the phones. Jason in Minneapolis, you're on with Ben.
Hi, guys. I had a question about bird calls being different in different parts of the country. For example, I travel for work, and I listen to cardinals here in Minneapolis. But when I go to Indiana, I notice the cardinals sometimes sound different. And the same thing with chickadees.
Absolutely.
That Southern is, accent, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. There actually is or are accents in birds. And I noticed that the more you spend time with them, this is a very astute observation, quite honestly, because I thought about it last night wanting to maybe bring it up. If you travel from here in the Twin Cities up to the Saxim Bog and are really tuned into black-capped chickadees, you will notice a difference in their call. It's very subtle, but you'll notice it's there. Additionally, some species are considered a single species, and the only way to really tell them apart as a subspecies is by their call. They have regional variations. A song sparrow is notorious for this. You can travel to all different parts of the continental United States and probably hear 6, 8, 10 different varieties of song sparrow. They're all the same species, but when they've become geographically isolated over time, they just kind of drifted into a different dialect with one another. And absolutely, from a cardinal standpoint, go down to Mexico, go down to Arizona as well, you will hear different cardinals. In fact, there's a proposal to split that species into 6 different birds.
The cardinal.
The northern cardinal, what we consider the northern cardinal, because there are differences in feather or plumage in their crest, as well as their call variants. Everything changes with geological shift.
Back to the phones. Paul in St. Paul, you're on with Ben.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to mention that there's an economic benefit to birding in Minnesota as well. My organization, Elpis Enterprises, has built and distributed over 50,000 cedar bird feeders to the Twin Cities area, which has allowed us to hire several hundred youth experiencing homelessness as part of our work readiness program. And so we appreciate Minnesota's love of birds because it has allowed us to create these products and get them out of the community and employ kids at the same time.
All right. That's good news. And Ben, talk to me a little bit about this. Birding is big business. I mean, this is a worthwhile endeavor. But beyond that, I mean, there are millions of people just like you.
Yeah, there really are.
Well, maybe not millions.
Well, yeah.
There are 4 or 5 like you, but millions of people who watch birds. Right?
Yeah, once your imagination is captured and you go down what we call the slippery slope, you're an at-risk birder when you just bird, and then you run into somebody that birds the way that I do, the way that some of my friends do. When you kind of go into beast mode when it comes to birding, that really puts you in a whole different category, but there is a lot of money behind it. I'm not going to lie to you. When you buy a scope from Swarovski, you've pretty much given up any, you know, having a lot of extra income hanging around. You're buying devices that are costing a lot of money. There is a lot of opportunities out there, but you do bring an economic impact everywhere you go. When you find a rare bird in a location that doesn't get a lot of traction, you could bring 50 to 100, 200 birders. Those people are using gas stations. They're using restaurants. They're doing a lot of things. There is an economic flow with these to see these birds, to go to these areas. Townships and areas up around Sac-Zim Bog are taking advantage of that. Meadowlands is one of the small cities around there, and they're hosting every year the Sac-Zim Bog Bird Festival, and they're gaining that economic impact from it and saying, hey, you know, everybody wants to see birds, then let's welcome them to town.
Right. Well, we just have a minute or so left. You mentioned Sac-Zim's, the bog up in northern Minnesota. Give us two or three other locations right around now, let's say March into April, that you would suggest to our listeners would be a good spot to go to check out some migratory birds.
Yes. Over the weekend, Greg Janer, Pete Nichols, and myself, kind of the three key birders of Washington County as far as the current generation goes, we went to Gray Cloud Dunes SNA. I highly encourage people to take a look at the DNR's offerings in the scientific natural areas. They're not formal parks in a sense. They're natural areas that don't have a lot of facilities. It's at the top of the river valley, unique landforms. We stand up at the top of what we call Mount Washington and watch flyover waterfall. Just find a river valley, get to the top of something, and watch the birds fly over, because it's happening right now.
Well, Ben Douglas, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Your blog is updated regularly with your expeditions to see birds, right?
It is, yeah.
Well, thanks again. I hope you'll come back and visit with us. And this song that we're leaving, of course, is none other than Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers playing what else but Rare Bird Alert. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thank you very much.